Go ahead and get started for the second session. And I'm delighted to introduce Florence Dzerzhinsky, Assistant Professor of Parasitology and Canada Research Chair in Parasite Pathogenesis. And Florence is a professor here at the Institute of Parasitology at McGill, and she will be moderating this session for us. So, Florence, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. Good morning, everyone. It's a real pleasure to moderate this session on innovative technology for global health. As you'll see, we'll have another outstanding panel of four scientists. The first talk would be by Dr. Alan Evans, who is a James McGill Professor in Neurology, Psychiatry, and Biomedical Engineering at McGill University, and the director of the Montreal Consortium for Brain Imaging Research. Then we'll have another talk by the Dr. Hamish Fraser. He's the director of Informatics and Telemedicine at Partners in Health. He's also an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and Division of Global Health Equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Then we'll take a series of questions for the two first panelists to follow with another panel, the Dr. Victoria Edge, who is a senior epidemiologist at the Public Health Agency of Canada and also an adjunct professor at the Department of Population of Medicine at the University of Guelph. She's accompanied by Ms. Sherilee Harper, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of Population Medicine, Ontario Veterinary College at the University of Guelph. So the first speaker today, Dr. Alan Evans, did his undergraduate studies at Liverpool University in the UK. He completed his PhD in biophysics, studying the 3D folding patterns of protein structures and the binding of cofactors and substrates to enzymes. He then spends 5 years at Atomic Energy of Canada LTD in Ottawa. He's worked on the physics and biochemical analysis of positron emission tomography, or PET for short, on this data. And then in 1984, he moved to the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill to continue his PET research. His research interests include multimodal brain imaging with PET and MRI, image processing and large brain database analysis. He has published over 350 publications in peer-review journals, and he holds numerous NIH and CHR grants. During his 25 years at the MNI, he has held numerous leadership roles, most notably as a director of the McConnell Brain Imaging Center during the 90s. Dr. Evans is a founder member of the International Consortium for Brain Mapping. He is one of the founders of the Organization for Human Brain Mapping, serving in numerous positions on the OHBM Council since 1995. He chaired the fourth International Conference on Human Brain Mapping in 1998. He is a regular participant in numerous NIH workshop panels and initiatives related to brain imaging research. He's on the scientific advisory board of numerous research programs on this field. And in 2003, he received a Senior Scientist Award from CHR. He is currently the PI of the Montreal Consortium for Brain Imaging Research. It is actually a $35 million multicenter initiative to network the BIC with six other institutions engaged in research in psychiatry, neurology, development, and aging. Dr. Evans is also the founder and the director of Biospective, which is a Montreal-based company that specializes in image analysis for clinical and preclinical pharmaceutical studies. Dr. Evans.
Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Tim. I feel something of a fraud because my world is brain imaging research, and I really don't think I know that much about global health, but I hope that some of the infrastructures and technologies that I'll describe might be of relevance to this community. So I'm going to talk about brain mapping, and I want to make a distinction between brain mapping and brain imaging. In brain mapping, we're bringing together the physical sciences, imaging technology, high-performance computing, along with clinical expertise in basic neuroscience. We use various types of imaging device, MRI scanners, to look at anatomy and blood flow, PET to look at receptor distributions and enzymes, and EEG or MEG to look at brain electrophysiology. These are the kinds of things that we do. You see on the top, in the middle, you see the changing stimulus to the brain. It's just a rotating checkerboard. And you see here the just the changes in retinotopic mapping in response to that stimulus. We do similar studies to look at language processing in brain or pain processing in brain. Choose your behavior and we can map its distribution in brain. This is basically you represented on your brain, your sensory or motor homunculus that was first established by Wilder Penfield in the 40s at the Montreal Neurological Institute, and now we just do the same thing in so-called normal McGill students. The key concept in everything that I'm going to describe is disarmingly trivial. It's stereotaxic space. We squash everybody's brain into the same shoebox. And this has profound consequences because you can then do many things within that shoebox. You can labs around the world can repeat experiments and compare the results directly rather than just looking at somebody's results in a paper 2 years after the work was done. The raw image data and process maps can be readily shared amongst labs, and results are reproducible. Networks of labs can share data and algorithms. Data repositories for global scientific community can be placed on the web, and new questions can be asked of mapped data long after the primary questions were completed. And new algorithms, of course, can be applied to old data. And most importantly, I think, especially for this setting, the principles here are completely adaptable to any species, rats, monkeys, humans, any imaging modality, MRI or PET, and any organ system. It's not just brain. We can have a stereotaxic brain that I'll be talking about, but one can also talk about the stereotaxic heart space. We do lots of processing, and I'm not going to bore you with the details here today. But a lot of it is pipeline processing, as in we put potentially hundreds or even thousands of brain data sets in at one end and lots of results. Quantified analysis comes out the other end. So one example of that might be this. This was a study of multiple sclerosis across 500 patients. 1,800 studies were collected. And all the data was brought to our lab, and what you see here on the left is one typical MS patient with a few identifiable lesions. The thing on the right, which looks like a Klingon starship, the green stuff, is the probability distribution of where you expect to find MS lesions in a population of 425 subjects. The idea here is that you can now test whether your drug works in a quantifiable manner by looking at does the green stuff get bigger or smaller across this population. You can take the subjective clinical assessment out of the equation and do a straight statistical map. You can also look at spatial distributions and spatial variation of your response to therapy. Next example is the NIH MRI study of normal brain development, where data were collected across the United States and brought to Montreal using a web-based infrastructure. All the data was transferred from the MR scanner or the behavioral laptop where all the behavioral instruments were collected and shipped into the data coordinating center and analyzed in the pipelines and then made available to the scientific community. For this, we used a web-based database system called Loris, which allows us to monitor multi-center studies on the fly. It's a project management system as well as a repository of data. It's two-way communication. So this allows us to store behavioral instruments of any kind, imaging information, and more latterly, genetic information. In that particular study that was conducted over a 10-year period in the U.S., these were the ranges of behavioral instruments that were collected on these children. It's a mixture of experimental neuroscience and clinical psychology. And for those interested, that paper was written up to describe the maturation of the normal brain. And for instance, you see in the top left panel here the separation in performance for the California Verbal Learning Task for boys and girls changing at puberty. And interestingly, the boys perform better on that task, perhaps surprisingly. On the other hand, down here, down here on the right, you see that girls outperform boys on manual dexterity at about the same age. There's an infinite amount of data of this nature that you can download and play with. We also studied a population of 100 children from birth to 4.5 years of age with an entirely different set of behavioral instruments because the kids are younger. And this is, for example, a result obtained from that data. That's a clock ticking in months, you can see up there. And what you're seeing is three different types of MRI image through the average brain of that population. And you'll see the maturation on the left. What you see now on the left, look, you see gray and white differentiation, the myelination of brain. I'll let this wrap around and you'll see what this looked like at birth. Don't worry so much about the other two image types. It's for another kind of talk. But look at this on the left at birth again. And then you follow the maturation, the myelination, for instance, of the optic radiations from the thalamus here down to the visual cortex in the first 6 months. And then from 6 months to 12 months, when your child starts to become sentient and aware and of the outside world, you see the corresponding maturation of the frontal cortex, allowing the integration of that sensory information. We can quantify that. These are maps. The bottom, perhaps look at the bottom one for the time being, showing you the areas of most rapid growth and continuing growth in this population of 90 children. And what you're seeing over time is that the back of the brain, the blue colors, stop growing after about 24 months, but the neocortex is continuing to grow. And projects that we're engaged in right now look at this same kind of data in, for instance, autism or any other developmental abnormality, developmental disorder, and compare it to this normal brain database. So we're quantifying in three dimensions growth. This database is available for scientific community use at an NIH website placed there. And another one, this is brain, this is the same data but analyzed in a different way, showing you the brain surface growing across the population. The green color is basically showing a bulge on the left parieto occipital temporal area, which is a junction integration area in brain. We can use these kinds of techniques to look at changes in abnormal development. So you're looking at here population of ADHD versus normal children, and you see a delayed maturation in frontal cortex by about 2 years. Interestingly, in the same population, there was one part of the brain which grew more in a more exaggerated manner in the early development of these children, and that was motor cortex, which makes perfect sense with an ADHD hyperactivity population. So that's the kind of data that we're collecting. We're engaged in numerous national and international networks which look at autism or Alzheimer's disease or normal brain development. And we're particularly fortunate in Canada that we have an agency such as Canary, which is set up specifically to fund high-performance telecommunication and high-performance computing projects in all kinds of settings, and they've been kind enough to fund us in the brain context. And Canada is very well served in terms of its international high telecommunication bandwidth linkages, as this map clearly demonstrates. So we've established CBrain, which allows us to bring various brain imaging research centers around the country together onto that CBrain high-performance telecommunication and computational network. So we have distributed data, distributed architecture for processing large amounts of data. In fact, we have, in theory, up to 30,000 processors available to us. So Canada is in a unique position to play a hub role on the international scene with this capability for processing large amounts of data. These are some of the international sites that we're engaged with within the context of our brain imaging research network. Some of them are using our tools. Some of them are exchanging data with us. I don't have time to go into great detail about all of these, but you see links in the Far East, in the Middle East, lots of sites in Europe. A few examples. The Gusto project is a birth cohort in Singapore where they're looking at 1,200 children to look at epigenetic impact on child development. I was just in Singapore last week, so if I'm a little bit gaga, it's because I haven't got back to local time zone yet. Same infrastructure exactly is being used in a multinational study in Europe of Alzheimer's disease. Six countries are shipping data from around Europe into a central hub, which is in Sweden. But that hub is actually being connected directly to our lab here in Montreal, and we're essentially the wizard behind the curtain in this particular context. Here's an example of those kinds of data. This is showing you cortical thinning in Alzheimer's disease as a clock ticks in years. And the red stuff is showing you the areas of most immediate atrophy, and you see it taking place in the mesial temporal areas, which is the area that we think is demonstrating the memory losses that you see clinically. It's horrifying. One of the projects that we're engaged in that I mentioned in that map is the Latin American Brain Mapping Network, LabMan. And this is basically headed by my friend and colleague, Fidel Castro. Pedro Valdez Sosa on the left is our colleague, and the guy on the right is Keith Worsley, mathematician, statistician, a longtime colleague of mine. And together, we've potentiated linkages between those countries that you see in color, who are all using either software and tools developed here or in Havana by Pedro's group. And this is quite a remarkable story. Time doesn't allow great detail, but suffice it to say, he has 90 sites across the country linked up, collecting EEG data that all goes to the central hub in Havana. And they're doing the kinds of statistical analysis that I've been describing. This is the one country I'd say that is really using these brain mapping research techniques in the clinic. And they are applying them to a variety of different disorders that you see here. And they've just launched the Cuban dementia and Alzheimer's study using much the same kind of data that I briefly described. We're also engaged with the National Brain Research Center in India. NBRC and our colleagues there and in the Indian Statistical Institute in Kolkata are working to establish an Indian brain imaging research network, particularly aimed at diseases which affect India in particular, and Alzheimer's is one of those. Back to technology, we're setting up various linkages between our own grid in C-Brain and European and U.S. equivalents. And we are calling this G-Brain. This links us to Germany, to Korea, and the U.S. again. Lots of wiring, and it's all because we have this simple concept of a brain shoebox. It really is enormously powerful. And so, to summarize what we're trying to set up, we have an environment which has a well-defined target community and a spatial framework for combining results from different experiments, a high-profile neuroscience community, a lot of software infrastructure already in place. High-performance computing tools are well established, as are high-bandwidth linkages to U.S., Europe, and Asia. And so we see this McGill Center for Neuroinformatics and Genomics providing these various functions, which you can read there. Again, everything that I've described is adaptable to any species, organ, or modality. Thank you.